Okay, it's the 26th of February, a great day. Buffalo Bill Coach's birthday. Just wouldn't let you know that in case you're so inclined. Next assignment's not due until next week, right? So, yeah, so chapter 5, that's the thing. But if you haven't turned in your other assignments, turn them in. I accept late work. I want you to do it. I think it's more important that you do it than the grade you get. So please turn it in. We're still standing. I know. Look at Apple. I'm telling you, folks, I think Apple's a phenomenal buy for the long term, presuming that they do this TV, whatever it's going to be, right? If they do that right, oh boy. What? I think so. I think so. But you got to realize that it's going to be really, really volatile. It's going to be volatile. I mean, we're going to take a look at companies that are the antithesis of Apple, and we'll see that, you know, they're not as volatile as companies like Apple and Google and the Forest books of the world. But we're going to get that when we get to chapter 6. And we're already discussing it. Any questions about your assignments at all? Because we had gotten to the point where we had discussed dividends. Do we like dividends?
Yes.
Yes, we do. And we're going to finish up. We should finish up chapter 5. Maybe not, maybe so. But first, we need a good joke. No good jokes? Did I tell you about the alligator walked into the pool? And the duck and the rhinoceros? Did I tell you about the rhinoceros? Yeah, I think I did. And the neutron. How about the condominium? The attractive, sophisticated, well-dressed, svelte condominium? Yeah? Okay. Well, let me tell you. This attractive, sophisticated, well-dressed, svelte condominium walks into a bar. Have you heard this one before? And she orders a daiquiri, because, you know, she's sophisticated. And the bartender goes to make her a daiquiri, and there's this stately Windsor mansion on the other side of the bar, and he gives the bartender a look like, I'll pay for this, my good man. So the bartender makes a daiquiri, brings it back to the attractive, well-dressed, sophisticated, svelte condominium, who takes out a purse and goes to pay and says, how much? And the bartender says, oh, no, that's okay. It's
on the house.
Yeah. I know it's a sickness. I can't help it. It's a sickness. So we ended with our discussion of PE, all right? Or maybe we didn't get here. Did we get to PE? I didn't think so. Okay. Price to earnings ratio, folks. This is the most talked about, discussed, analyzed stock statistic in, other than people talking about the price, in our universe of statistics and indicators and the like. And we'll come back to it over and over again. It's a simple calculation, folks. It really is a simple calculation. You take the price and you divide it by the earnings. That's it. But oh boy, is there quite a bit of meaning in that. It's the stock price divided by the earnings. In our previous example that we've been using, the stock price was $20 per share. That's what it's selling for in the open market. It earned $2 last year per share. So you take 20 divided by 2 and you get 10. Now don't put dollar sign, don't put percent sign. It is unitless. There's no units for PE. Some people put a percent sign or a dollar sign. Don't do it. Traditionally, stocks sold for a PE of anywhere from 5 to 14, and a PE of 20 was only reserved for the fastest growing stocks. If you had a PE of 20, that meant you were a real fast growing company. But what happened, and this wasn't the only time, but in the 1980s and 1990s, PEs just went to the moon. And it's happened before in the late 1920s. It happened in the 60s. You know, not quite as bad as it happened in the 90s. And in the 2008 turmoil, PE ratios came down greatly. And so we will discuss it in detail more and more. But in essence, the PE tells you what investors believe the prospects for the future of the company are. It doesn't mean they're right. But when they bid up the price relative to the earnings, they're saying they believe the future for that company is very bright. If the PE is very low, that means investors are not so excited about the prospects for the company. Okay? And there's a whole bunch of other things that we'll learn how to read into the price-earnings ratio. But that's all you have to know now. Do you want to take a look at some companies? Real quick? Okay. Let's look at some of our companies that are in our portfolio. So, for example, Caterpillar. What's the PE of Caterpillar? 10.5. This is one of the things I ask you to look up in Chapter 5. And once you start doing it, you'll find it's not hard to do. You just look, use Yahoo or Bloomberg or MarketWatch. I would go to the library and look up the PE. And so what are investors saying about Caterpillar? 10. Yeah, they're not too excited about Caterpillar's prospects. 10 is fairly low by today's standards. 15, 16 is about average. How about Coca-Cola? What do they say about Coca-Cola? 19.24. Investors are pretty excited about the prospects for Coke. How about, what is it? We look at, yes.
The prospects for Coke, what kind of...
How many people are going to ingest, keep drinking it? Exactly. How many people are going to ingest carbonated sugar water with a brown crayon dipped in it?
What
is it, a world, right?
The lower it is, it's like,
yeah, right.
In
this country?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. For Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola is a global company.
Right.
They sell 80, they get 80% of their revenue outside the United States.
Right.
Yeah. So investors are saying, you know, we think Coke's prospects are pretty good. Let me show you Apple. This is the thing that kills you about Apple. I mean, everybody talks about Apple, but look at their PE. That's low, folks. That's very low for a company growing the rate of Apple. It's very low. People got real excited with Apple, bid up the price from 200 to 700, and now they've knocked it down because all of a sudden people are going to stop lining up around the block and buying the latest new thing that they already have the four previous ones. What about Facebook? Have you ever seen a company, ever hear of a company called Facebook? What's their PE? 1,792. Yeah, 1,792 PE. What? It does make money, but it makes a little bit of money. And so what are investors saying about the future prospects of Facebook?
There's a lot of opportunities.
They are going to either start making money hand over fist, or people are nuts. People have bid up the price because it's an IPO, which stands for it's probably overpriced. And what's going to happen? Well...
How long did you
stay overpriced? Not, well, it depends. In the late 1990s, they stayed overpriced for years. And then Peter Lynch calls it the Wile E. Coyote syndrome, the roadrunner. You know, he runs off the cliff and he's standing there in midair and he kind of goes, what's going on? And he looks down, and then he finally falls. So eventually, Facebook better start producing or their price. You see? The price is going to go. I don't think they're going to go. No, they're not going anywhere. Anyway, anytime soon, you know, technology changes quickly, but they have, what, almost a billion? That doesn't mean everybody uses it. I have a Facebook account, but I never use it. People send me requests to be their friends. I don't use it. It says right on my page, I don't use it. The only reason I grabbed Wonder Professor is somebody else wouldn't grab it, and then there'd be confusion with my students. Okay, so we're going to come back to PE quite a bit. Now, we need to take a look at stock worksheet number 2 now to do some calculations. All right, pass this out. Okay. All right, so the first group is what we've already done. Where do you find a company? Where do you think you're going to find a company? Of course, you might not be right, and so in which case you just look it up and you'll know the answer. But where do you think you'd find Microsoft? NASDAQ, right. NASDAQ, technology company, and that's where it is. How about GE? The New York Stock Exchange, right? It's been around since the 1800s. It's the only Dow stock that was in the Dow in 1896 when it was created. How about Flim Flam Incorporated? Oh, they make bacon stretchers. No, left-handed smoke shifters. OTC, bulletin boards, pink sheets, exactly. How about AMD? Who are they? Advanced Micro Devices. They're the only competitor in the PC market to Intel. They make chips that do the same thing that Intel chips do for your PCs. Where would you find AMD? You think NASDAQ, right? It's on the New York Stock Exchange. So, you know, see, that's where that's where you think, you know, okay, I'll look over. Oh, they're not there. So they're on the New York Stock Exchange. And it's not, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to disparage their chips. Their chips are very good. The company has been just barely keeping alive. And it's the kind of situation that we had back in the late 90s where Microsoft wanted Apple to stay alive so they would have a competitor. Intel wants AMD to stay alive so that the Justice Department will leave them alone. And we're like, we got a competitor here. Stay alive, please. And then what about the Diamond Exchange Traded Funds? Right. You could put this is an exchange traded fund that tracks the diamond, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. You could put any of them because they trade everywhere. But if you put New York Stock Exchange, MICKET, Market, MKT, that would be fine. That would be a tip of the hat because the exchange traded funds started on the Amex, which is now called the New York Stock Exchange, MICKET, Market, whatever. But you could put any. Just write down any. That would work. And what about International Paper? No, they're actually a very old company. They've been around a long time. They used to be in the Dow. They're on the New York Stock Exchange. They make paper products, and when you make paper products, you also make building products. When you make building products, you make paper products. They're byproducts of one another. So, again, Microsoft's on the NASDAQ, right? And if it were a different world 20 years ago, they would have moved to the New York Stock Exchange. But Intel, Microsoft, Oracle, Google, Apple, we're very happy at the NASDAQ. And that's when the New York Stock Exchange... Oh, no. General Electric, yeah. Yeah, it's one of the oldest companies in the country. Okay, excellent. Sorry? Well, that's what those terms, they were very popular in the late 90s. You don't hear them anymore, but they were old economy versus new economy. Now, here's what I want you to do right here. We want to do this part. We'll come back to this part in a second. So, number 16. Widgets Incorporated is selling for $50. Its earnings last year were $3.50 per share and is paying a dividend of $2 per share. Please compute the following. So, widgets. You know what widgets are, right? Thingamabobs, Chuchkas, you know, whatever. And they're currently, their market price is $50. All right? And their earnings per share, we normally see it as EPS, $3.50. And then the dividend per share is $2. So how do we compute the price to earnings ratio? The price, $50, divided by the earnings per share, $3.50. And what is their Rogelio's on it? You guys got to come on, wake up, get your calculators. 15? 14.2. Come on, get your calculators out, wake up. Did you have your coffee? I don't drink this stuff. I love the smell of coffee, but I hate the taste, and I don't like the taste. I'm already nervous enough. Okay, everybody get that? Yes. Not your head, yes. Or go, no, Frank, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Got it.
Okay, the next one is the dividend payout ratio. So the dividend payout ratio, this is what we did last Thursday. We didn't finish, I apologize. The dividend payout ratio is equal to the amount of dividends they're paying divided by their earnings per share. See, they're paying $2 in dividends. they're earning $3.50. How much of their earnings are they paying out to investors? So what is that? Somebody in the cheap seats? $2 of dividends divided by $3.50 of earnings, or 0.57, or you could write it as 57%, as either one would be fine. That is a percentage. Don't put a percentage down for PE. That is unitless. Okay, want to give this to Anna? And then, everybody understand that one? These are easy calculations, folks. Make sure. Other side, Anna. Other side. Okay. And then the last one is the dividend yield. The dividend yield is equal to the amount of dividends we earn divided by the market price. In other words, we compare it as if we were buying a bond or a savings account or something like that. So what's the dividends? Everyone should say $2. Everybody tell you, ask you, what's the dividends?
$2.
And what's the market price?
$50.
So 0.04 or 4%, either one. So this stock is paying us 4%. Now, remember, the price goes up and down, and the dividends, they could change at any time. They could stop paying dividends, or they can increase the dividend, or they can decrease the dividend at any time. Questions? Are these calculations that hard?
No.
Everyone should say no. I'm sorry?
Either one
what? Well, this is the, I'm sorry, say it again.
I thought you said you can use the dividend or... The market
price is how much we have to pay. The dividends are what the company is paying us, $2. If we have one share, we get $2 of dividends, and then they earn $3.50. So we compute their PE by taking the market price divided by the earnings per share, and this is selling for 14.2. Is that high? Is it low? What's about average, folks?
10.
About 14, 15, right? Okay. So that's about average. 10 is a little on the low side. 20 is on the high side. All right. And then 17,092 is fairyland. Okay. And then we did the dividend by the market, divided by the market price. That's the dividend yield. That tells us, as a percentage, how much the stock is paying us. We pay them $50, they will give us $2 per year, that's 4%. Yeah? Okay, I get a lot of blank stares. I'm not sure if I should continue or yes. No, you don't have to. For these two, for these two, you can put the percentage, or you can just leave it as a decimal. Either way, it's up to you. But this one, don't put a percent. I mean, if you do, I'm not going to slap you across the face or anything, but just don't do it. You don't put a percentage for price-to-earnings ratio. It's unitless. Okay, so now, what we're going to do, some of you have already seen this, because I do this in the Business 1.1 class. We're going to discuss the types of stocks, because people have a tendency to just lump all companies together. But you know intuitively that all companies are not the same. Right? They're just very different. I mean, how do you compare a utility company to a high-tech startup? They have very different characteristics. Blue chip companies. What are blue chips? Right. Big, venerable. You like that word? Venerable. I always like that word. Blue chip companies are companies that have been around for a long time, and they are going to be around for a long time. Every once in a while, one of them disappears and somebody else takes their place. They have a long history of high quality earnings, dividends, and often referred to as value stocks. And they attract conservative investors. Now, there's nothing to do with politics, folks. Not conservative and liberal. It means investors who want to invest in stocks, but don't want to shoot the moon, don't want to try to make a whole lot of money quickly. Because you won't. Peter Lynch calls them the stalwarts. He uses that word, stalwart. And if that helps, fine. You know, stalwart. So, example, General Electric. Yeah, in 2008, they got in a whole lot of trouble because most people don't realize that GE makes more money now off of their financial businesses than they do off of making locomotives and powers of plants and what? Appliances and they make medical equipment. But their financial arm, they owned NBC for several years. They just sold it a couple years ago. And they are coming back. They're coming back, as we'll see. General Motors? Yeah. Used to be the world's largest corporation in terms of revenues. And that company is gone. The new GM came out of bankruptcy as a different company. So are they a blue chip now? I don't know. It depends on who you talk to, but I guess so. Is Google a blue chip?
Hasn't been around long.
Yeah, I know. The McDonald's of the world and the Johnson & Johnson's would go, oh, only been around 10 years. But they're certainly priced as one. They're certainly priced as one. The next group are called income stocks. And these are stocks that we normally buy for their dividends. They are also sometimes called value companies. They are normally slow growth companies in mature industries. And the poster child for an income stock is a utility. Right? Are utilities going anywhere? Do they have any competition? Is there somebody going to compete with SDG&E? And you're going to be able to say, I don't want my electricity to come from SDG&E. I want it to come from here. It's going to happen. They tried it about 12 years ago. It was an utter failure. Okay, they're going to do it. All right, we'll see. We'll see. They tried it in 1999-2000. It was an utter failure. And then the banks traditionally were staid, boring, slow growth until they started playing games in the 1980s, 90s, and the 2000s. And then, so we might want to cross that one off of our list. What are they now? They're still getting over the turmoil. Now, the stars, folks, are the growth stocks. These are the stocks with the nice hair, you know, and nice teeth and bulging muscles. What? Superstars. They're on the cover of Vogue and GQ. And these are companies that are experiencing high rates of growth, 15 to 20%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but if you are growing at 20%, in 3 years, you'd weigh twice as much of what you weigh now. That's how fast 20% growth is. They usually do not pay dividends, or maybe a small amount of dividends. Why? Because most of the money is coming back into the company. You understand?
Right.
Most of the money is going back into the company. The stock price should go up, but it's going to be very volatile. And so let's look at examples. Intel, Microsoft, wait a minute, Dell? Are these growth stocks anymore? Well, in the case of Dell, the PC market is starting to shrink. And so Intel, they better do something quickly. They're not stupid, folks. They're going to push up against the mobile. They're not really big in the mobile market, but I'm sure they will be. They're not stupid. I remember back, this was 20 years ago, when you've never heard these terms, but CISC and RISC processors were battling it out, and Intel traditionally made CISC processors, and then a few other companies came up with these RISC processors, and Intel at first was poo-pooing them, they knew they were better. And then all of a sudden, there's this press release, HP uses Intel new RISC processor for their line of Hewlett-Packard LaserJet printers. Like, they're not stupid. So eventually, they're going to be in the mobile market. But these were growth star stocks 20 years ago in the 1990s. Right? And then throughout the 90s, these were the prima donnas. Who are the growth stocks now? Apple, Google, Facebook, right, exactly. So those are the and then somebody mentioned it. Who was it? Mentioned 3D systems? Who was that? He's not here today. We'll take a look at 3D systems, don't worry. You know, you're worried about China becoming the next, you know, everything's going to be made in China. No, no. In 20 years, no. In 20 years, everything will be made in your garage. You're going to buy a printer.
Oh, your 3D printer?
3D printers, right. You're going to buy a printer that you know, online. What?
You can get a printer out of that thing. It's awesome.
Yeah, so So yeah, that's going to be the growth stock. We don't know which one's going to be. What? DDD, yes. We'll take a look at them. Relax. Breathe deeply. We'll take a look at them later on. Okay, now, read this carefully. Let's read carefully. Growth versus value. The investment world loves to use the terms growth and value. The meaning of the terms, though, are not exact. It depends on who you're talking to, how they're using those terms. Typically, investors often use growth to designate a high PE stock. And they use value to designate a low PE stock. But what they're using it in the way that I would not use value. When I think of the term value, I think of something that's worthwhile. Do you understand? Is it a good value? It might have a high PE. It might have a low PE. And here's a great example. In January of 2005, Google had gone public in August of 2004. So it had gone from 85 to 200. And it was selling for a PE of about 60-something. I remember 67 or something like that. The old GM, which is now gone, right, was selling for $34 with a very low PE, about 6, 5 or 6, and it was paying tremendous dividends, even though it really wasn't making much money. Today, Google sells, it just went over 800, by the way. Did you see that? It just popped over 800 with a much lower PE, and the old GM, which is now called Motors Liquidation, last sold for 4 cents in March of 2011, and now is worthless. So which one was the better value in January of 2005? In my lexicon, in my usage of the language, I would have said Google's a much better value. But investors will say, no, Google was a growth stock, GM was a value stock. Because Google had the high PE, GM had the low PE. Understand? Right, and they use the term value often when they're talking about low PE stocks. So be careful how you use or how you, when you listen to me talk to other investors, how you use the term value. Are you with me? Well, you'll, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's like the opposite, it's that value is not really.
Well, it's not the opposite. They're just using it in a different way. I got to come back to you, what you said. They're using value to say this is a low PE stock. And I say, no, you use value, or at least I like to use value, when you see a company that looks like it's worth some serious change. And now I'll get back to yours. You will take it out of, you will understand what they're talking about in context. And if not, you want to ask them. Are you saying, do you mean value because it's a low PE stock? But you'll almost always be able to understand it when you are talking with them, getting it out of context. Make sense? Okay, let's continue. All right. Now, the next group are called cyclical stocks. Cyclical stocks are companies that are linked to the general state of the economy. When the economy does well, they do well. When the economy does poorly, they are poor. They do poorly. And the poster child, so to speak, are the automobiles. When the economy does well, it's growing, people are getting jobs, they're getting raises. What do? What's the first thing they do? Run out and buy a new car. How's the old one? No, I want a new car. And when the economy does poorly, the old company car is doing very well. And this is what happened in the Great Recession a few years ago. The average age of cars in the United States went over 12 years, which has never been that old. There's a lot of old cars on the road. Part of that is just cars are better built these days. And you can keep a car for a long time. I love having an old car. I don't know about you. Who's going to steal my car? Nobody. Nobody going to steal my car.
But I said, you stole my 1984.
Oh, you know why? Because they wanted the transmission out of it, probably. Yeah, that's the problem. That is the problem. Once you get, they get really old, like, oh, I can't find a transmission. There's one. Okay. And then any companies that make stuff. Chemicals, timbers, metals, steel, companies that make stuff. Why? Because there's more stuff being made. And so they need the components of that stuff. And so Intel has now become a cyclical company. And Intel and other chip manufacturers, because everything you buy these days has a chip in it, right? Even your shoes.
Oh, that's crazy.
It is crazy. But that's the world. They're so cheap. Why not throw it in there and have the... Well, you see those shoes where they...
Yeah.
It's crazy. And so those are cyclical companies. Now, on the other side of the coin are what are we call defensive companies, not defense manufacturers that make bullets and planes and that part. These are companies that tend to hold their own and even do well, ironically, when the economy starts to falter. They remain stable, or relatively, they won't go down as much during declines in the market. And they are often, but not always, associated with income stocks. So, Kellogg's, think about it. Food, General Mills, Cheerios. You want to eat more Cheerios because the economy's booming? Are you going to eat less Cheerios because the economy's booming? Right, you have to eat something. Procter & Gamble, are you going to use more soap? More shampoo because the economy's booming?
Yes.
Oh, you are? You're going to shower more to go out? Are you going to use less soap and less toilet paper and less toothpaste? I hope not. And drug companies are also in there, too. Because if you need your insulin, it doesn't matter if the economy is booming or not, you're going to
buy it.
And so what happens is when the economy starts to falter, the growth stocks, the cyclical stocks get hit, but the defensive stocks sometimes even go up because the investors, specifically more growth, more aggressive investors, the traders, the speculators, will rotate out of the growth and the cyclicals into the defensive. And this is what happened in the 2000 to 2002 bear market. The growth stocks, the cyclical stocks, when the economy did poorly in 2001 or so, defensive stocks actually did pretty well. Okay, turnarounds. Turnarounds, I don't like to call them turnarounds. I like to call them goners because they usually don't turn around. When a company has fallen on hard times, Dell, there's a good example. What? Best Buy, right. They're excellent examples of the turnaround. Circuit City was a goner. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, these are excellent examples. You have to ask yourself when you're an investor, is there a potential for a rebound? Because most people don't know this, some of you, because you weren't born yet, but in the early 80s, Chrysler almost disappeared. It literally almost went away. And the price went from 40-something down to 3. Yeah. And then it did start turning around. A gentleman by the name of Lee Iacocca, you business entrepreneur people, he is the one who started the Mustang at Ford. In the mid '60s, he did. I don't know if he was the designer, but he was the manager. He was the one who got the Mustang out the door, and then he eventually took the job at Chrysler to turn around Chrysler, and he did it. And the stock went from 3 up to 47. So that's what you have to ask yourself. Ford and GM and Chrysler are turning themselves around. Best Buy and Dell, we'll see if they're able to do that. But Kodak?
Best Buy is gone.
And what do people do? Yeah, they walk into Best Buy, check out all the things, and they go buy it on Amazon.
Yes.
And don't pay any sales tax.
That's true.
Yeah, but they're going to be paying sales tax soon. Yeah, Amazon made an agreement with the state. They'll start collecting it.
Sold out?
That's the law. And, of course, all of you who buy stuff off Amazon always send in your sales tax, right? Like you're supposed to?
No.
What?
Don't you do that?
No.
My son asked me, what should I do? I said, well, you're legally supposed to send in the sales tax. He looked at me like I was out of space. I said, well, that's the law. You can do what you want. And so he did it. He didn't want to. What? I don't normally buy off the internet, but if I do, I sent it in. I bought something. All right, it's up to you. That's why the states, they were about ready to go after Amazon and the others. They were about ready to have their way with them. No, they're not jealous. What you've set up is a situation where some companies are following the law and other companies aren't. You know, I'm not saying you have to agree with the law. I'm not saying you have to like the law, but you have to follow the law, right? You can disagree with the court, but you can't disobey the court. Go right ahead. You know, it's up to you. What?
Call
our bail bondsman here. We'll talk to you later. No, they don't put you in jail for that. They just hit you with a huge fine. A company that is sitting on an asset is called an asset play stock. And this is where you have to dig deeper. You have to dig deeper. JCPenney's, for example, in the recession in 2000-2001, many of the department stores, they're still struggling. The department stores, Montgomery Ward's, Broadway, Robinson's May, then Robinson's May. Who else? Mervon. Broadway, they're gone, right? And what's happening is, and Sears and Kmart, you know, no one's told them they're gone yet. And they are being hit below from the Targets and the Walmarts of the world, and they're getting hit from above from the boutique places. So JCPenney's was a little in trouble. Now they're in trouble again, but it's for a different... What? Yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But they still have it. They had an insurance company. It's called Stonebridge or something. They're the people who send you something when you have a baby and saying, wouldn't you like to have insurance for your baby? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They could have easily sold that asset to keep the company afloat. So when you see an asset play, you really have to dig deeper. They're a little trickier. And then, of course, we shouldn't even talk about these impolite company, the penny stocks. These are the flim-flams of the world. They are they're just nothing but trash. Stay away from them. They're on the pink sheets. They're on the bulletin board. There's some examples on the website. Maybe we'll come back to it in a bit, but we got to get through chapter 5. Okay. Hopefully. Okay. Any questions? Any thoughts?
Is there any such company as flim-flam?
Yeah, I think so. I think they know. Maybe they're still in business. Maybe not. They made the left-handed smoke shifters. Did you hear about that? The left-handed smoke shifter. It's going to do a whole lot better than the blue steam that they sold last year. The blue steam.
Hey, where did that stop? Whatever happened to oxygen machines?
Oxygen machines? Yeah. They're the people who made the oxygen machines. There they are, right there. I'm going to sell you the oxygen. Here, sign up right here. Don't breathe this oxygen. This is bad oxygen. This is good oxygen. Breathe that. Okay. And then the last group are foreign stocks, international stocks. And the problem with this is that it's gotten ridiculous. It's just there are some companies that are based outside the United States that do a majority of their business inside the United States. There are some companies that are based inside the United States that do a majority of their company outside the United States. So how do you call them foreign? And traditionally, it was very difficult, to close to impossible, for retail investors like you and me to transact. But not anymore. Most brokerage firms now have international accounts, which allow you to have dollars in your account and pesos and euros and yens, so you could buy the stocks on foreign exchanges in that currency. But before that, and still, most people will buy foreign companies using what are called American depository receipts, sometimes called global depository receipts. What they do is they take a company like Sony or Nokia. And Sony's in Japan, Nokia, Finland. And a trust company or a major bank on Wall Street will pick up a whole bunch of shares and move them into New York or New York, United States. And then they will reissue them dollar denominated. And so that makes it easy for us to buy Toyota, makes it easy for us to buy Sony and the like. So they're called ADRs. Of course, most of us grunts are going to buy our foreign stocks using global and international mutual funds. I think that's, and it depends. If you know Latin America and you want to have bolivars and yen, I'm not yen, pesos and whatever. Who uses the dollar? Does somebody, Panama, they use the dollar down and they use the dollar. And then here's the deal. We discussed this a little bit. We'll discuss it again. If the dollar goes down, what happens to your investment in Mexico or in Japan? It goes up. All the things being equal, they never are. If the dollar goes up, It's the exact opposite. It's a seesaw, and we'll see that idea later on. So what you have to ask yourself, if you're an investor in foreign issues, is will the dollar be weaker or stronger over the next 10, 15 years? What do you think? You guys don't want to give an opinion. Many people say the dollar is going to go into the toilet. The dollar is going to be worthless. What? Weak. I would say it's going to be weaker. They say it's worthless now. You ever hear people say that? Our dollar is worthless. I say, oh, you think the dollar is worthless? Yeah, exactly. Here's a bag. Go to your bank. Pull out all those worthless dollars, and I'll buy you a pizza or whatever. You know, just give them to me. Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be the weaker side, mostly because we're importing all this oil. But, folks, what's happening is we are increasing our production of oil dramatically, and natural gas, and we are decreasing our consumption. Without even a comprehensive energy policy. And so the dollar might actually strengthen over the next few 10, 20 years. We'll see. More Chevy Volt, getting good reviews.
It has to be strengthened, the dollar, because now the United States is taking their own oil, because before they don't.
Yes, they don't use it at all. Right. We are using new technologies to get a whole lot more oil out of the ground, a whole lot more natural gas. It used to be that we were sending $800 billion with a B out to other countries every year, and now that is down to about $200 billion. We have reduced our intake, our import of foreign energy substantially. And some people are saying 10 years from now, we might be energy independent. We might not import any oil, on balance. Well, I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen, but it might.
Is it new companies that are emerging that are doing these
No, it's mostly older companies.
So like Chevron is actually...
Chevron and the people that Chevron buys stuff from, Schlumberger, Halliburton, Transocean, these other companies that actually... See, Chevron and BP and Exxon, they drill the oil, right? But they don't build the drilling equipment. They contract with Schlumberger. I always want to call it Schlumberger, but it's Schlumberger. And they contract with Halliburton. And Halliburton goes there and builds the drilling equipment. And then Chevron takes it out of the ground, refines it, sends it to their gas stations, and the like. The oil industry, folks, many people say, oh, those oil companies, they're so greedy. Like, no. I mean, yeah, sure, they're out to make a profit. But what you want the price of gas to go down?
Yes.
Stop using it. It's that easy. It's that easy. You know, people say, oh, I'm paying $5 a gallon. That's why you're paying $5 a gallon, because you're paying for it. If you stop paying for it, the price would go down. There's a bus out there. You can get a bicycle, right? A little moto. Get a moto. What?
We can get around when nobody has cars and everybody's on the public system.
Well, that's different, isn't it? Okay, that's when you pull out the car. But if you need, I know people, they go, oh, I live 3 miles from work. I couldn't ride a bike.
Wow.
You could walk 3 miles. Walk 3 miles. Okay, capitalism. I know, I have a heart attack. Oh, we're not going to move. Okay, capitalization. It's a fancy term for how much the company is worth, folks. It's a fancy term, and one of the things you're going to look up, you don't have to do the calculation because it's done for you. But there are three major categories: the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears. And we discussed this a little bit. We looked at mutual funds. When you see large cap, mid cap, small cap, they're just not spelling out the whole word. It stands for mid capitalization, large capitalization. And we discussed, which are the most stable companies? Everyone say large. Which are the most stable companies?
Large.
Who are the most precarious? Small. Well, let's forget penny for now. Small caps, and then mid caps are in between. And then there are two subcategories that I hope you'll remember, but if you don't, it's not the end of the world. Mega cap and micro cap. Now, let's define the biggie. Large cap is normally defined as anything above $10 billion. Once you reach $10 billion of market capitalization, you're a large cap company. Mid cap is anywhere from $1 or $2 billion, it depends on who you talk to, up to about $10 billion. And then small cap is less than $1 billion or $2 billion. Once you get below about $75 million, $100 million, $50 million, depends on who you talk to, that's the micro cap world. And once you get above $100 billion, now you're in the mega cap world. So what you need to remember is large, mid, small. If you remember mega and micro, that's fine. And then again, even in small, in flight company, we shouldn't even discuss penny stocks. Because these companies are not real companies. They're somebody's garage in Ohio or someplace somewhere out there. Okay? All right, so let's take a look at an example. $20, our stock, has 5 million shares. You multiply the 20 times the 5 million, and you get $100 million of market capitalization. The price, for the most part, folks, the price is irrelevant. People talk about the price. Don't talk to me about the price until you tell me what the market capitalization is, how many shares are outstanding. You must look at the market cap to see what the value of the company is. Remember Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway? $145,000 stock? There's a whole lot fewer shares than Procter & Gamble or Coca-Cola, but it's up there. Warren Buffett's company is up there with those mega cap stocks, but still you have to look at the valuation. So here's a couple of companies you might have heard of. Ever hear of Walmart and Target? Good. Okay. Just as of February 8th, the price of Walmart was $671 and $71.50, and the price of Target was $62.50. And so, looking at the price, you'd say, well, they're kind of the same size, right? Wait a minute. Who intuitively do you think is a whole lot bigger?
Walmart.
Right, and you're right. There's 3.35 billion shares of Walmart. There are only 651 million shares of Target. So, Walmart's capitalization as of about February 8th, $239 billion, where...
What do you mean by shares of Target?
That's how many shares are out there. That's how many shares people to buy, and people are holding on to, and some are trading them. That's how many shares are out there.
That's how many total shares.
That's how many total shares of Walmart there are.
Not how many are available to buy.
Well, how many are available to buy is how many are available people are willing to sell. You see, and if the price goes up, there'll be more available to buy because people will try to sell them. And if the price goes down, there'll be more available to sell because people will try to buy. You understand? It's called the market. You know, exactly. Some people are just happy to hold on to their Walmart shares. And other people are saying, you know, I need a new washer and dryer, so I'm going to sell my shares. Or I'm looking to invest. I'll buy some shares. You see? Okay. They're both large cap companies, aren't they? But Walmart is a mega cap, and it's about what, 6 times bigger than Target? Yeah. Okay, how about these two? You ever hear of them? AT&T and Verizon? No, they're two different companies. They're two very different companies. They're both in the cell phone business. But they're two different companies. And you look at the price of AT&T, $35, and the price of Verizon, you might think that AT&T is smaller than Verizon. The old AT&T is gone. The old AT&T is gone. The new AT&T used to be SBC Communications, which bought Pac Bell, which bought Bell South, which bought Chicago Ameritech or something like that. There are 5.5 billion shares of AT&T, 2.86 billion shares of Verizon. So AT&T market capitalization is 196 billion. Verizon is 126 billion. They're both very large companies, but AT&T is a whole lot bigger. So if you wanted to buy AT&T, you'd have to have $200 billion in your pocket and walk on down to New York Stock Exchange and say, I want to buy AT&T. Does it work that way?
No.
No, it doesn't. Because if you started to buy every share that was being offered to bid, what would happen? What would happen to the price? it would start rising because there's some fool out there buying every share that's available. And so if you're looking to buy another company, what you need to do is you need to get, first of all, probably 230, 240, and you have to pay more. Because as soon as you start trying to buy all the shares, it was going to go up anyway. So you have to make what's called a tender offer. You go to the New York Stock Exchange, you go to the NASDAQ and say, usually it's another company, we're looking to buy this company. So we're going to make a tender offer at $42 a share or $39 a share. And this is very sensitive information. Right, you understand? Can you imagine what's going to happen as soon as that information... Exactly. He's got to get his number. Okay, in case... Because if you have that information and you trade on that before it's publicly announced, that's a crime. That's a crime. Call Rogelio. And so they will say, okay, great. At such and such a time, they announce the tender offers, and as soon as they say, okay, we have a tender offer for $42 for AT&T, if investors believe that it's a bona fide, you know, real offer, the price will jump immediately to, you know, $41.80, something like that. So you see what kind of hanky-panky can go on with these tender offers? And sometimes companies doing it, they do it just to sort of knock the price up, because they have no intention of really buying the company. These are called corporate raiders.
Yeah. So is it the SEC that would investigate any, what they would call, suspicious?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And are there major cases...
Oh yeah, Heinz was just bought by Berkshire Hathaway, right? And there was Heinz, the ketchup people, and there were some serious violations. They caught them red-handed. Yeah, they caught them. They got the person, whoever it was, it's somewhere in Europe. Somebody knew, and they used a European exchange to do it. Somebody knew that was going to happen, and they bought a whole bunch of the options. We'll talk about it later, but they bought a whole bunch of instruments, knowing full well that Heinz was going to pop, and they made a fortune overnight, and their hands are bloody. They got them. Because there are algorithms sniffing out this kind of activity. If for example, if I knew that Heinz was going to be purchased, and I called my boss and said, "Hey, boss, I want you to buy for me 100 contracts of Heinz option contracts," and he'd go, "What? You've never bought an option in your life. What are you doing? Just trust me on this." They would come down on me like a ton of bricks. Because he never bought an option in his life. Now he buys 100 2 days before Heinz goes up 50 point whatever. No, they would come down on you because the computer will just go bing, there it is. it'll look like a big red flag. Now, if you're the kind of person who buys and sells options all the time, and you all of a sudden, you know, just happen to be buying the Heinz options right before the price popped up, they'd probably go, "Oh no.
He got lucky."
He got lucky, yeah.
But you'd have to be
showing
that history.
Yeah, you'd have to show that history of gambling, basically.
So they look at your...
They look at your history. Oh, yeah. They look at the algorithms.
Very starting with the gambling.
You know, I don't know. They I don't know. You got incredibly lucky? Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. Anyway, so now let's take a look at some investment strategies. Oh, we might... Maybe not. All right. I'll need some paper. Need some room. There are just dozens of investment strategies, folks. But let's take a look at some of the major ones. And we'll be finished, I think. Buy and hold. Oops, wrong color. I've got to change these. Buy and hold. This is the one that Warren Buffett and Peter Lynch will tell you to use. Use fundamental analysis to identify high-quality companies with good growth prospects and potential for dividends at reasonable prices. It's also sometimes called value investing and growth at a reasonable price. I always like that, GARP. GARP, value investing. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You have to decide what's reasonable for you, and we'll discuss that when we get to chapter 6. And what? GARP, growth at a reasonable price. GARP. It was a book. You know, it's a guy who wrote a book. I guess I don't know if he got the idea from this, but he wrote a book called The Life According to GARP. It was a movie. The movie wasn't that good, but the book was excellent. And you hold it for the long term. And they once asked Warren Buffett, they said, well, Mr. Buffett, you're a buy and hold investor, right? So how long should you hold something? Hold it forever. Now, he's being facetious, right? You don't live forever. But in other words, just as Mr. Bogle said in the chapter one, you buy a company and you hold on to it, as if you had bought a pizza shop or a...
Like a kid. You hold on to property A and you let them go.
What did he say?
You feed them, nurture them, they grow up, and you
kick them out. And you kick them out, right? Yeah, and then when you're ready to retire, you start selling your shares. And here's a really great, I forget where I got the damn thing, but it's a really good graphic. Don't lose perspective. This chart traces the month-by-month percentage returns of global stocks. This is the MSCI Global Index. Remember the MSCI Global Index? So this is month-to-month, 12 months in every year. And you look at that and you go, how do you make any sense out of that? Right? If you're trying to predict when the best time to buy and the best time to sell, and you see the market do this kind of thing, are you going to be able to figure out? But if you simply extend your time horizon year to year, this is what the market did in the 1990s, the MSCI Global. Do you understand? If you're trying to buy, you know, and sell and buy and sell, buy when it's a good time, sell when it's a good... All I can say is good luck. Because I don't know anybody's going to do it. I certainly ain't going to try. I've never been able to do it. Not that I've ever tried. But all the statistics tell us that it's almost impossible to do, if not. I mean, that's some of you saying, you got to be extremely lucky. Any questions, any thoughts? Do you like that? Does it show it?
Is that a certain period?
Yeah, 1990s. The MSCI World Index from December 31st, 1990 to December 31st, 2000. And having dividends reinvested. Started off with $10,000, went up to $12,000, down a little bit. Went up and then up and up, and then the late 90s were unbelievable, folks. That doesn't happen too often. It happens every 20, 30 years or so. And then 1999, they actually, international stocks, global stocks actually went down in
99.
Where is it now? I'd have to run the numbers for it. But it did pretty well until 2008, and then everybody fell down, and we're clawing our way back. Questions? Another way is from the income strategy, which we've already discussed a little bit, right? We've already discussed the idea of buying shares of stocks and then having your brokerage firm automatically reinvest those shares back into the company, right? Nod your head yes. You remember that? We emphasize equity income funds, equity income stocks, dividends. We emphasize dividends over capital appreciation. Ideally, we're looking for growing dividends. We're looking for companies that are growing their dividends. And companies that consistently pay dividends tend to do well when the market as a whole does poorly. They're often called defensive stocks. In general, they are appropriate for conservative stock investors. And remember the DRIPs? The dividend reinvestment plans? Nod your head yes. If not, you need to go back and look at the presentation again. Stocks which have had histories of consistent dividend increases have often been the market's best long-term investments, like Procter & Gamble, like Coca-Cola, like Philip Morris. The growth strategy. This is the one that is on the cover of GQ and Vogue and everything. Investing in stocks with above-average forecast of earnings growth. Dividends are a secondary concern or not a concern. They usually have high price-to-earnings ratios and expectation of higher earnings in the future. The growth stocks are the stars. Everyone wants to jump on the bandwagon as a company is experiencing strong growth last year, Apple. Subsequently, the stock price has been up to high levels. The price-to-earnings ratio goes up. Everybody thinks the world's going to continue to go. It's going to be blue skies. And then they are also the stocks that they are riskiest. When the slightest hint of a slowdown in the growth appears, the stock price is often brutally punished. So you got to sort of jump out before everybody else jumps out. Or just realize that this is the kind of company I want to invest in, I'll buy more and just have a long-term approach.
In regards to Apple, it's like thousands of stocks, so that's why if it's going to drop $2,000 or $200, you want to get out of the 200 times 2,000 is 2 million, no?
Well, it depends how many shares you own. How many shares you own. But when Apple went up to $700 a share, there were reports it's going to go to 1,000, and people were just getting giddy. This is the kind of thing that happens. And yeah, no, he's right on time. And then it, subsequently, there was just a little bit of problems there, a little bit of things didn't quite look as rosy, and the price went from 700 to 450, 500. So you have to be ready for that. I remember sitting at a party. This woman I just met, and she had just jumped in on Apple when it was, I don't know, she paid $600 or something for it, and she was so bitter because it's now down to $480 or something like that. And I kept trying to say, well, it's a long-term process. You have to realize that a company like Apple is going to be very volatile. But if they execute this ITV, or whatever they're calling Apple TV, they should do really well. They have the opportunity to double their earnings.
So you're saying you buy stocks right now on Apple, it's more like 450?
If that's the kind of stock you want to buy, if that's the kind of roller coaster you want to ride on, I think Apple's a good deal for the long term. But I will preface that by saying, do you think they're going to continue to execute as well as they did over the last 5-6 years since they came out with the iPhone? Do you believe that? If so, yes. If not, then hey, yes. Yes, Nicholas? That's okay. All right, great. Aggressive growth. Now here's the one that just, you know, I just feel so sorry for people who get suckered into doing this. Aggressive growth. These are the kind of people who are speculating, short-term trading. Trading in and out of stocks in order to achieve eye-catching returns. Instead of waiting 3 to 5 years for a stock to move, an aggressive trader would go after the same investment return in 6 months, or 3 months, or 3 weeks, or 3 minutes. Some traders have time horizons in the weeks or days, and our companies are using computers to make millions of trades per day. Figure that one out. This is the strategy that many people think they're supposed to use when they start investing in stocks. It is fraught with perils and drawbacks, not the least of which are the serious transaction costs that can be generated as a result of frequent trading. Stockbrokers simply adore suckers. Traders who use this strategy. So this is what people think. They get $10,000 and they think, this is what I got to do. They get the screen, they buy some software that lets them track what's going to happen, and they sit in front of the screen and they... All I can say is good luck. Want to hit the light? This is a documentary from the late 90s. Uh-oh, I can't see anything. And here, I'm just going to show you just one little piece with this woman who literally got, she's just not the only one. She got suckered into the, she's not the only one. The whole video is about this. But they've been buying and selling stocks. And
they sold Microsoft. The next time you caught up with her, she and Lawson put their life savings into two tiny volatile technologies.
Two tiny biotech.
Because we're working very hard and not furthering ourselves. It's too slow. We have got to do something aggressive.
It's scary, but, you know, at this point, she just wants to, she took a little more and just invested recently that was very conservative, and she kind of went and did something that I think will lay that on. As well as the one that does a crash. But yeah, right now, just about everything's in there.
What did she do?
She went and invested in the stock that she was told was going to do very well.
So she doesn't even know the name of it. I know the call letters are AMLN. It's supposed to double by August. Do you worry about your future financially?
Well, yeah.
With good reason.
All the time. That's why we're trying to do something nice. That's what I'm saying. There's really nothing to depend on except yourself. So, you know, we worry about it.
The money.
AMLN, Amylin Pharmaceuticals, based here in San Diego, subsequently went down almost 80%. This is
worse?
We don't know. Do you understand what she's doing? She gets a tip from somebody, and this is when you know that stocks are way overpriced. But this was in 1996. It kept doing this for three more years. Just like 2003. Housing prices can't keep going up. Oh, yeah, they can. They did it for three more years, four more years until they crashed. So are you going to be an aggressive trader? And if you do, at least know what the name of your company is. Oh, my goodness. I just cringe when I see. What's going on here? Come on. Go back. Okay, contrarian. Now, contrarian, this is very cool, but it's not easy. Contrarians are investors that want to run the other way. Investing in stocks that are out of favor with markets for some reason, as reflected by low price earnings ratios, low prices compared to their fundamentals. Contrarian investors actively seek stocks from companies with sound financial statements that the market is undervalued. And I like this one quote from a contrarian. I always try to be accommodating. I buy when others want to sell, and I sell when others want to buy. The problem is it's difficult. The market goes up, on average, over the decades, three times for every 1 year it goes down. So, you know, if you're always selling what everybody else is buying, you're eventually going to run out of stocks, right? You're going to be out of the game. So here's another famous contrarian. It's not a steady business. You have to be willing to sit on your hands and then wait for those disasters or wait for those times when people are giddy and buying stocks because somebody told them it was going to double in 8 months and they don't even know what the name of it is. You understand? And that's what people like Warren Buffett did. He sat on his hands for the most part throughout the 2000s, and then when the organic matter hit the Ventolin device, the wheels fell off, whatever you want to call it, he swooped in and bought $5 billion worth of GE, $5 billion worth of Goldman Sachs, eventually bought some Bank of America. Would you do that while everybody else is screaming and hollering and running around? You would? Okay. It's easier to say than it is to do, yeah. I can tell you honestly that I kept putting my 401, 403B and my Roth IRA contributions in as it was falling. And then these three I call dumb, dumb, and dumber. Sector rotation, buying stocks in hot sectors, selling them as stale ones. You have to decide which ones are hot and which ones are not. Momentum investing, buying stocks as they go up, selling stocks as they go down. This is often associated with aggressive growth. It's called the greater fool theory, folks. Somebody out there is a greater fool than I am. And if I buy it at this price, doesn't matter if it's worth about here, somebody's going to buy it at that price and that price. And it's like musical chairs. It's fine while the music's going, but when that music stops, yeah. Market timing. Don't ever try market timing, folks. This is a great, here's a famous investor from the mid-1900s. Don't try to buy at the bottom and sell at the top. It can't be done except by liars. And often they lie to themselves. They'll tell you that they did really, really well that one time, all the other 17 times they didn't. And so those are the major strategies. And of course, I'm going to ask you which strategy you favor, and you're going to go, buy and hold. Because if I said buy and hold. But do you understand the risks involved with each one?
Growth.
Yeah, growth. Okay. Growth is good, but you got to be nimble. You got to watch what you're doing. And that is chapter 5. Woo! We got through it. I didn't think we were going to get through it today. But we did. And you think I'm going to let you go 5 minutes early? Hell no. No. Because I want to pass this out and get you started on chapter 6. Because we got just a couple of slides to take a look at. Because you really need to. I know, thought if you don't have the book, you're not reading the book, go to the library. The book is on reserve. Not for... Well, if everything goes well, the next two sessions, it'll be next Thursday on chapters 5 and 6. Because you need to keep studying this stuff in chapter 5 every day, folks. You need to know what dividends are like, what the odd lots. You need to know about the NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange. You need to know about the different types of stocks, the different types of investment approaches. I want you to study it. Chapter 6, folks, there's not a whole lot of content. It's all calculations. And so we're going to spend the next two sessions just doing the calculations. So please come here. I'll bring a coffee for you. Okay, you get here. Get here for the next two sessions. If you miss the next two sessions, you need to do your best to get your butt on the internet and watching those presentations, because this stuff, this is it. This is the heart of the semester. If you understand what we're going to do over the next two sessions, maybe three, you are going to be so... I mean, it doesn't mean you're going to be a phenomenal investor, but you will see. You will see, okay, that's outrageously priced. That doesn't mean it won't go up. Doesn't mean they won't grow their earnings in such a way that it makes sense for you to buy. Or you will go, that might be a very good investment. But it doesn't mean you're going to be right. Because we're going to learn how to value stocks. And I'll tell you right off the bat, it ain't easy. In fact, it's almost impossible. And there have been some people who have been very good at it, and there are a lot of people who are very bad at it. But if you follow the techniques here, you should do well. Believe me, there are no guarantees, but if the world doesn't fall apart, which is always a big if, and if the whole system doesn't crack and crumble and we're all left with nothing, by doing these techniques, you will identify companies that have good long-term growth prospects, and some of them will do well and some of them won't do well, but you'll increase your odds. And then we start with this wonderful quote. Value matters, folks. You ignore value at your peril. This guy has over 35 years of experience, all right? So he knows what he's talking about. He's been able to stay in this business for over 35 years. Stock valuation is the process by which the underlying value of a stock is established on the basis of its forecasted risk versus return. At any given time, the price of a share of common stock depends on investors' expectations about the future behavior of the security. That woman bought the stock because she thought it was going to double in 8 months. She didn't buy it because it doubled 8 months prior. A fundamental assertion of finance holds that the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows. The worth of a company is primarily based on the earnings the company will produce in the future. But if we knew what's going to happen in the future, we know what's going to happen in the future? No. So we are going to have a very difficult time doing this. If we knew what's going to happen in the future, we wouldn't call it the future. It's easy to go back in the past. People say, well, if you had followed my methodology for the last 20 years, well, were you espousing that methodology 20 years ago? No. They're saying now. Is it going to work for the next 20 years? I don't know. And this is from a wonderful book called The Random Walk Down Wall Street. The most fundamental influence on stock prices is the level and duration of the future growth of earnings and dividends. However, future earnings growth is not easily estimated, even by market professionals. You know, just because they got a stockbroker name or a mutual fund manager name, does it mean they're going to be able to estimate future earnings? The companies themselves have a hard time knowing what's going to happen in the future. And they're the ones selling their products. So if someone were to ask you, what is the most important fact in determining the future value of a company? What is the most important fact determining the future? In a future, in few words, you could say future earnings or future dividends. What's the company worth? It's worth what it will produce in the future in the terms of earnings and then possibly dividends. But do any of us know what's going to happen in the future? So is valuing stock going to be easy?
No.
No. Everyone say no. Wait till I ask you. Is valuing stock going to be easy?
No.
No. But over the next two sessions, we are going to learn some techniques that should tilt the odds in your favor. Okay. So you're all going to be here on Thursday, right? Okay. Call up your friends who weren't here. Get them here on Thursday, 9:30. See you.
Should we get here earlier?
Get here earlier. Get here earlier. And we'll start early. 10? No, not 10:30. Okay.